This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spelling's tenure as president of the University of North Carolina system was met with criticism and a flurry of controversy. After 2 years in the job, though, that is but a distant memory. In those 2 years, she has launched a new planning process focused on making our state the nation's leader in college affordability. She's focused on student success, and she's restructured the university's administration to support and advance those priorities and others. And she's gained the confidence of other top university leaders. When I asked UNC Charlotte Chancellor Phil Dubois about Spelling's just the other day and whether she was working out, he told me yes. And when I asked why, he said, for one thing, she listens. Margaret Spelling's joined us on this program shortly after taking the reins on March 1st, 2016, and she's going to spend this hour with us as well to talk about maintaining the reputation of what has long been regarded as one of the finest universities in the nation. Margaret Spelling's, welcome back to the program. Welcome back to Charlotte.
Thank you, Mike.
Good
to
see you.
Glad to be here.
First of all, condolences are in order. I have to pass those along to all those Tar Heel fans out there.
Sad morning.
Well, kind of bittersweet for you, but we talked about this the first time you were here. You grew up in Texas.
I did.
So are your allegiances somewhat split here this morning?
Well, maybe the slightest bit, but, Tar Heel born, Tar Heel bred. When we die, we're Tar Heel dead around here, right?
Right. Well, our condolences. Enough said.
Thanks for
so
that.
So how have these first 2 years been for you?
Well, it's been a terrific honor to lead this incredible institution, which makes such a difference to the lives of North Carolinians and really makes a difference here and around the world. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a challenging time to be in public life, as everybody can tell who watches it. And there's a real irony, at a time when most of the people in our country and in our state need what we do, need post-secondary education, the value of it, the confidence in our public institutions, including American higher education, is somewhat in question. So it's a fun time to be in public life. There's lots to do, and it's critically important to our state.
There are all these statistics about how people succeed with a four-year degree and how they succeed even more with a master's degree.
The million-dollar difference.
Yes. All these stories. And if you go through a four-year college education at a good school and you do well, you become the elite. You become an educated person. And yet there seems to be in this country at this point in time a prejudice against the elite and a kind of resentment of people who are well educated. Do you feel that too?
Well, I think, when people look at college and they see prices going up and are struggling with affordability, it doesn't matter that we're one of the most affordable places in the nation. They're not comparing us to our peers. They're comparing us to their savings account and their paycheck. And so I do think, for people who don't see college for them or because it's affordable, that gap, that resentment, that divide is fostered. But what I know for sure is that we are an affordable system, and we take people from all walks of life and get them in and out of college with a credential that is worth something, and we do that in really affordable ways for everybody.
You are on a 7-campus tour of the university system right now. You've done this before. You're doing it now, and I think that UNC Charlotte is the first
stop. It is
stop.
My first stop, absolutely.
Why? Why start here?
Well, a big driver of enrollment growth in the system is here, is at UNC Charlotte, because it's part of a dynamic city. It's a place where we have close relationships with employers, and our employers are telling us we need more high-skilled people. And so the growth of the system is being driven by UNC Charlotte. It seems like a great place to start.
We were recently, we talked with Phil Dubois about this, I think about a week and a half ago or 2 weeks ago, and we were passed over by Amazon as a possible second headquarters city, although Raleigh, Durham, Chapel Hill is still in the running. And one of the reasons we were passed over was because of the lack of a research facility. Well, UNC Charlotte, they like to point out, is a research university and highly competent in computer technology.
Absolutely.
One of the best systems in the country for that.
That's right.
Is the university not doing a good job of letting the world know that?
That's part of it. Absolutely. We hide our light under a bushel often, and we do a lot of incredible research here, particularly in those domains. But we're also primarily a comprehensive university that is providing access to affordable higher education for everybody. That's our core mission here.
And when I say the university not getting the word out, I'm talking about the system, not just the University of North Carolina, Charlotte. I'm talking about the university.
That's true. And that's why I'm here. And that's why we're doing a 7-city tour. We punch way above our weight. We have $1.5 billion of federal funding and research funding that comes here. And it's one of the largest shares in the country. Mm.
I know you said you believe that you've made a lot of progress in the first 2 years as the president of the system. You're pleased, you say, but not satisfied. What are you most pleased about?
Well, I'm pleased that the board has unanimously adopted a strategic plan that is really very clear and concise and powerful around some serious objectives like affordability, accountability, which means we've got to hold ourselves to account about performance and do better, and access. We need to make sure that all people feel like they are wanted and welcome and can be successful in these systems. Mm-hmm. So it's not about me. It's about a group project of a strategic plan that's been developed and now being implemented by each of our 17 institutions. Every single one of the chancellors and I have signed a performance agreement, which talks about their specific piece of that action. Here in Charlotte, Phil and I have signed an agreement that says they're going to increase rural enrollments, they're going to close the achievement gap on student completions, they're going to raise research funding, and on and on. Each one of these institutions has a tailored remit that's around our strategic plan.
It's a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
So what are you least satisfied about?
Well, I think we need to create a college-going culture in our state. People need to see it as an opportunity that is for them. You know, we have big divides in our state, rural and urban. And, you know, if you're poor in this state and in the South generally—
And in Charlotte particularly.
And in Charlotte in particular, I'll say that in my remarks this afternoon, you know, your prospects are pretty dim unless you access post-secondary education. And so we need to work on those divides if we're going to live in a vibrant state.
But that divide begins in about the third grade. So how can a university system help?
Absolutely. Be the best at preparing teachers to go into our public schools. We are the driving force in teacher preparation in this state. Most of the teachers in our public schools come from the UNC system. And so that's why I asked a group of researchers to look under the hood at our teacher preparation programs, all 14 of them, and tell us, you know, how are we doing with respect to that? Are we teaching the state standards? Are we making sure that our teachers know the most effective research-based strategies and how to teach little children how to read in particular? And we found kind of a mixed bag. So our role in that is make sure that we have teachers that can be effective and successful when they get to our public schools.
Where did this strategic where did the strategic plan come from? Did it come out of whole cloth when you took the job, or did this emerge as you did the initial campus
tours? It was a giant process, as the kinds of things we love in American higher education. It's a good thing. We had town halls on every single campus. Our chancellors hosted meetings. It was a collaborative process that worked with our committee chairs and the board of governors, students, faculty, you name it, lots of input. And it netted out this very clear and concise plan around these major goals of access, affordability, and success.
I hate to dig up ancient history, but a lot of the people who were worried about you coming in were worried because of the way the exit of your predecessor, Tom Ross, was handled by the board, and the fact that they told him he did a great job, but he was going anyway.
Yeah.
And that led people to believe that perhaps there was an agenda in bringing you in, because you'd come from the George W. Bush administration, and we have just switched over from a Democrat to a Republican-led legislature. So people were concerned about, clearly, that has not been the case. And it seems the legislature has given you what you have called the best budget in 10 years. Is that because you're kind of a Republican and you're one of them, or is it because of something else?
It's because that we have a roaring economy in the great state of North Carolina, in no small part due to the power of this university. And when the economy roars along, the legislature is going to invest in higher education as they should and as they long have. Mm-hmm. So I will give them all the credit. And, you know, you're right. The process by which I entered North Carolina and entered this job was probably less than desirable. I had nothing to do, obviously, with the search, and consider Tom Ross a very able public servant and someone I'm proud to succeed.
Margaret Spellings is our guest. Margaret Spellings is our
That's
guest.
Right.
Excuse me. And you're a. Am I remembering this correctly? Do you come from a family of school teachers? Am I right?
I do
that?
Not. I do not. My dad was on the faculty at Eastern Michigan University for a while, but he's primarily a geologist.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, she's the president, as you may have noticed by now, the president of the University of North Carolina system. We're going to continue talking with her throughout the hour here on Charlotte Talks, here on WFAE. Well, let's talk about that budget, because it's the best budget, you say, in 10 years. That budget, how does that budget compare with previous years that you've been here, at least?
It's much better.
Much better, I guess, is the question.
Well, we were fully funded for enrollment growth. We did not get what's called a flex cut, where they give us our budget and then they take a haircut across the top. For the first time in many, many years, did not have one of those flex cuts in last year's budget. We'll be working with the legislature in May to make sure we don't have it in this coming year. But, you know, they funded priorities like NC Promise. We're lowering tuition to $500 a semester at three of our institutions beginning this fall. That's to the tune of a $51 million investment in those three institutions. They've invested in teachers and trying to recruit our best and brightest into our public school classrooms, and on and on and on. So, you know, there's a lot to commend it, and I really am proud that the legislature is investing in this university.
Why are they doing it at this point? Is it because
they know what we know, and that is that this state will not thrive and grow jobs and meet the needs of the research agenda and on without a strong and thriving University of North Carolina. You know, I was so heartened right after I arrived when the bond, the NC Connect bond passed by a 2-to-1 margin. The people in this state believe in and love their university. It's part of their communities. It's where they go for cultural life and for civic life, and they understand what it means to this state. It is what distinguishes North Carolina from every other state in the South, and frankly, it's the reason I came.
Okay. The legislature budget includes $8 million to upgrade the school's data collection and management systems, but it also includes a $7 million cut to be spread among most of the schools in the system. And I know you're planning to try and talk the legislature out of that $7 million cut, but if you're not successful, how will that impact what you're able to do and the school itself?
Well, that $7 million cut will come right off the top, and that's the flex cut that I was just referencing, and we'll be working on that with the legislature. With respect to the $8 million for data, you know, what has surprised me since I've arrived, and, you know, the Board of Governors and legislators ask me questions, you know, how much does it cost to do this, or which is better, this or that, and at particular preparation programs. And I say, you know what, I don't know. Why don't I know? Because we don't have the kind of data systems that we need to run this enterprise in an efficient and effective way. Mm-hmm. We have 17 different systems that have different terminologies and different charts of accounts and on and on and on. And so, you know, we can know more about our business. And when we do, we can improve it. We can make better use of resources. And so we've asked the legislature for $8 million. We've done a study. We're going to be presenting that at the Board of Governors meeting later this week in Wilmington. And, you know, we're in the era of big data. And that has come to higher education, too. And we need those investments.
Does that need to be, is that data collection and manipulation something that needs to be done at the university? Could you outsource that for a lower price? Would you want to? Or is it that the data so private protected.
I mean, we deal with a lot of, you know, financial information, with student data, with, you know, private type of information, and so typically these systems are built within the public sphere, and I think that's the right decision.
Margaret Spellings is our guest. We're going to come back and talk about a lot of things with regard to the University of North Carolina system. She's in town to make her State of the University speech today, as a matter of fact. We'll come back and talk about costs and goals in a moment. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spellings is our guest, the president of the University of North Carolina system. And she's here in Charlotte today to kick off a seven-campus tour of the system. You have said that you want to ensure that we get our rightful share of state resources because we are a big part of the success of North Carolina. And from what you said in the last segment, I take it the legislature is on the same page. They agree with you?
I think they agree with that largely. And that's why, and this isn't just a new idea they've come to. This state has long invested in public higher education. We are among the highest in terms of state share, legislative support for higher ed institutions in the mid to low 60s. 62% of our instructional costs come from the state. That compares to, I was in Arizona not long ago, 10 to 12%. In other big systems. So it's a major investment, and the legislature recognizes how it helps drive prosperity here.
Let's talk about cost and affordability. You said that one of the things that keeps you up at night is thinking about three big issues in higher education: value, price, and relevance. And one of your primary focuses has been on the affordability of attending the university. So before we talk about how you're working to keep the university system affordable, talk about why the cost of college has risen to unaffordable levels. I went to school on a student loan, paid my way through, graduated, thought I had this enormous debt. It's nothing compared to what kids are leaving school with today. Why has it gotten to be so expensive?
Well, over time, as I said a minute ago, the state share has diminished around the country. And so when state resources decline, institutions have to turn to tuition and fees to raise those additional resources. And so that's part of why tuition has outpaced the cost of everything else. That's why it's so important that as part of our strategic plan, we are holding ourselves accountable to not have tuition growth any faster than income growth in our state. Number one, and we're holding ourselves accountable for that. And two, why the legislature's investment in this program they call NC Promise, mm-hmm. which will reduce tuition to $500 a semester. Talk about as free as practicable, more like the kind of fees and tuition, Mike, that you and I paid when we were in college. It'll be $2,500 for out-of-state students, and that's going to be at Western Carolina University, UNC Pembroke, and Elizabeth City State University. So for that value shopper, there are three great UNC options for them.
When that first came up, and I'm trying to find it in my notes, I know that there was concern about what that would do, that reduction in tuition for certain students at those three schools that you referenced, what that would do to those schools and their ability to operate. Has that all been ironed out?
Absolutely. The legislature is backfilling the amount from what it would normally have cost to attend those institutions to this buy down, if you will, the cost to this $500 level. And that is going to cost the great state of North Carolina and the taxpayers therein $51 million a year. And so we'll be counting on the legislature to continue to provide those resources. I think that's where the skepticism was. I mean, could we trust the legislature over the long haul that they'd be good for those resources? And I think they will be.
If the cost of college has gone up because they're not just University of North Carolina system, but college, state systems throughout the country,
right,
since they're not getting the support they used to get in terms of state money flowing in, why aren't they getting that support? If these schools are economic drivers for the states in which they exist, why have states cut back on their support?
Well, in the recent past, in the aftermath of the 08 crash, recession, it was because states didn't have the money. And so when you are a major investor in public higher education and public K-12 education, that's largely where those cuts had to come, just because they had to cut the pattern to fit the cloth and make the budget work. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things—
But hasn't this been going on longer than 2008's
recession? It has. It has. And the good news is, if there is any, the silver lining is it's caused higher ed institutions to be leaner, to be more efficient, and to be more innovative. I've just given you the example of Arizona, mm-hmm. where their state share is significantly reduced and much lower than here. Well, they lead the world on technology-based education and have 37,000 or some high number like that of students enrolled online. It's a moneymaker for them. They have students all over the world taking classes at Arizona State University because of that innovation that was necessitated by a lack of resources.
You've talked about the economic driver aspect of a university education and what it does for the state, and I know that a lot of maybe most of the graduates from the university system stay in North Carolina,
They do.
So that absolutely does pay dividends over time because they're taxpayers.
Absolutely.
But
and business owners and entrepreneurs and public policymakers and doctors,
right,
and you name it.
And we always talk about their contribution, the contribution of a university education to the workforce. But should that be the sole function of higher education? Because if it is, what happens to English majors and history majors and philosophy majors?
Well, it's certainly not the sole function, but when you're investing in UNC Charlotte's case, you know, $22,000 for your tuition for a year, you know, you're going to need to pay it back, and you're going to need a J-O-B in order to do that. So right. We like to think that we're preparing people, obviously, for the workforce, but also for life and to be lifelong learners. You know, one of the things that I think people are surprised about is, you know, the nature of the student body has changed dramatically. The average age of a student here at UNCC is, you know, 22 years of age. Many of them have families and children and are, you know, returning to college after service in the military and on and on and on. And we all need to get used to the idea that we're all going to be lifelong learners coming in and out of college over our lives so that we can stay marketable and relevant and, you know, ready to compete in this world.
Because there was conversation not too long ago, probably during the last election cycle, about whether or not college was worth the money. Because if you're leaving college with $30,000, $40,000, $50,000, $60,000, $100,000 in debt, you're going to be 50 years old before you pay that off. And yes, you may earn some more money than you would have if you hadn't gone to college or if you hadn't gone to a tech school or something like that. But people were beginning to question whether it was worth it. And people were taking those conversations seriously. I mean, that really shocked me that people were taking that seriously. Does that figure into your thought process?
Absolutely. And this is where the big data issue comes into play, because what we owe our consumers is, you know, information about what their prospects are. If you have a degree in French literature, what are your prospects? If you have an engineering degree, what are your prospects? If you have a teaching certificate, what are your prospects? You know, how much, how fast, and to what end? And so we need big data, we need information so we can better empower our students to make those choices.
That goes back to the $8 million that you're getting to upgrade the data collection.
That's right.
So what does that money go to? Computers, servers, software? What does it go to?
Well, it's going to first go to some standardization of definitions so that we make sure that we're calling particular things the same thing across the institution so that when we gather that data, we'll know what it is. So it's standardization, it's change management, it's investing in people who can help lead those efforts. Yes, there will be some hardware that we'll need to be able to supercharge the collection of that data. But our leaders will be empowered with this information, and our taxpayers will be better served when we can be more efficient.
So when you have this information, when you're able to answer the legislature's questions, or when you're just posing your own questions, what kind of questions are you going to – what are you interested in finding out? What will you be able to know that you don't know now?
How much does it cost to have an engineering program at A&T versus NC State? Who's the most effective teacher preparation program? Who completes? Where do students complete the quickest? Who does best in our classrooms? How much does it cost to, you know, on and on and on?
And you don't know any of that right now? Really?
We know a lot less than you would think, you know, and that's one of the things that's so important about the system, the UNC system, the system platform is we can be a great leverager of information and talent and expertise across the system. And frankly, we're under-leveraging that platform now.
And we didn't know this in the 1950s because the technology didn't exist. Why do we need to know it now?
Well, because consumers, taxpayers, students, businesses were price sensitive. We want to know, are we getting something of value in an efficient and affordable way? And we owe folks that. I mean, you can find that out on TripAdvisor and Starbucks and, you name it. And we're so used to customization in every other area of our lives. And we need to be able to, you know, step up to the plate and do that in higher education.
If you can do it, but the University of Virginia cannot, and I'm just using them as an example, maybe they can, or the University of South Carolina cannot, does that give you a competitive advantage?
I think so. It absolutely does, because we're better able to tell our story with, as one of our board members likes to say, fact, data, and detail. And that matters.
Facts matter?
Facts.
Let me write that down.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me write that down.
Yeah, please. We are operating not in a fact-free zone.
you point out that in 2016-17, the university's graduating class included more than 16,000 Pell Grant recipients, and that Pell Grant is a subsidy by the federal government provided to students who need financial aid for their undergraduate degree. You also point out that in the 2015-16 academic year, the UNC system enrolled 65,709. You have these figures.
We do have that.
Undergraduate students who received a Pell Grant, and I know that you're dedicated to ensure, we've talked about this, ensuring that the university is accessible to the broadest number of people. Is that Is this how that you can achieve this goal, or is this just one tool?
One tool in the toolkit, an important one, that Pell Grant. But we have need and merit-based aid programs here in the state of North Carolina and, of course, at the institutional level as well. And right now, we have kind of a crazy quilt approach. So if you're first generation and you're trying to figure out how am I going to cobble together the necessary resources to get in and out of college, we make it pretty difficult. We also make it pretty difficult if you're a kid that's taken every advanced placement class that you can in your high school to understand, well, if I've got a 4 in chemistry, will it count at Appalachian or will it count at Chapel Hill or NC State? Well, that the answer is it depends. It's 17 different answers. And so we can take some of the friction out of these systems, both financial aid and other credit systems and whatnot, pathways between our community colleges, and make it more user-friendly for our students.
And you referenced this earlier. One of the things that you want to work on is economic mobility. And we have this problem in Charlotte that if you're born poor here, you're likely, and you stay here, you're likely to die poor here. You can't climb the ladder. Why is that the university's concern?
Because we are a major part of the ecosystem of this state, and we owe it to understand what's behind that. What does the research tell us about that problem? What are the most effective tools? And our Urban Institute here at UNCC is a big part of the scholarship around that issue. Why, who, where, and what do we do about it? Number one thing. Number two, as I said a bit ago, having the best quality teachers in our most disadvantaged schools is a big part of our remit. One of the things that we do wrong in American K-12 education, and I don't know the specifics about Charlotte in particular, but from my secretarial days, is we send, you know,
I should mention that the secretarial days is not when you were in the secretarial pool.
No,
you were the Secretary of Education.
That's right. That's right. Anyway, we often send our least experienced people to do the hardest work and into our most disadvantaged schools. And so we've got to pony up and pay our best teachers to do the hardest work, and that's often in our impoverished communities.
Toby on Twitter, and by the way, you can join us on Facebook and Twitter and email at charlottetalks@wfae.org and all the other ways. Toby on Twitter writes, "My daughter is in the 10th grade. We have lived on the cusp of poverty for her entire life. Thanks to wonderful, dedicated teachers who inspire the UNC system and hard work, she has a chance at a bright future, and she will be a scientist for NASA."
Fabulous.
One day.
Congratulations.
Aside from having an Urban Institute at UNC Charlotte, which does a lot of work in the Charlotte community and elsewhere to figure out who, what, where, and why, mm-hmm. and run statistics, how does the University of North Carolina plan to get involved in what ways in improving people's economic mobility prospects?
Well, as I said, our role in K-12 education, making sure we have teachers who are high quality going into each and every school.
But if you send them to the school, it's up to the system where they get assigned. You can't mandate.
Yes,
here comes the teacher, CMS. Put them here.
Well, we can be part of those policy discussions and issues. I mean, institutes like the Urban Institute can help us, you know, raise those policy prerogatives. But and we can make sure that every single teacher that comes out of this system is a great one. Next, we have an early college high school on this campus. I hope that maybe someday there'll be a lab school so we can get do some experimenting here in our university about what works best in K-12 education and bring that to bear. We have a terrific dean here at UNCC, Ellen McIntyre, who's part of a national group called Deans for Impact. So we're learning things about how we can be a better partner with K-12 education because that's where it starts. If we don't have students who come to our doors ready to be successful in higher education, you know, we're off to a not a very good start, and neither are they.
Are school systems, public school systems around the state on board with this? Are they willing to assign the best teachers to the least economically to the most economically stressed schools?
Well, often our employee agreements give teachers themselves the prerogative of where they want to work. And, of course, you know, teachers who have a lot of experience want to work in places that are, you know, in their own neighborhoods, right, or, you know, with kids who are easier to teach, candidly. One of the things that we're doing is we've launched a commission called My Future NC. We're one of only about 7 states that have not articulated a post-secondary attainment goal or really any goals across our system. Andrea Smith at Bank of America is one of the co-chairs of this effort. But we're bringing together leaders from all sides of the education continuum, but also faith-based based leaders and business leaders and the like to talk about how do we coordinate our systems more broadly.
Margaret Spellings is our guest, former Secretary of Education in Washington, and now the president of the University of North Carolina System. Sean Charlotte talks on WFAE. Let's talk about the achievement gap, because that's something that we talk a lot about when we have people from CMS on this program, closing the achievement gap. And we all know that people from lower socioeconomic income levels have a tougher time in elementary and junior high school and high school. And it's generally focused on African Americans and the Latino population. How does the university get involved in closing the achievement gap?
Several ways. One, we can help them figure out policies in our public policy institutes, the Urban Institute, our colleges of education. What are the strategies that are going to be most effective with those learners? How can we hew to the research of what we know about how those little children learn to read best? And so the good news is we know what to do. We know how to close the achievement gap. It's just that we need to do it more. And then again, as I keep saying, we need to make sure that we have teachers that are prepared to be successful.
States are now in the process of retooling No Child Left Behind, which I believe, I'm old and my brain is getting foggy.
You got it right.
It was an initiative of the Bush administration.
Absolutely.
The last Bush administration.
And proudly so.
What do you think about our state's proposal? Do you think and I don't even know what the proposal is. You tell me what it is. What do you think?
Well, the law was reauthorized, now called ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act, and it still has a lot of the core elements of No Child Left Behind, most notably annual assessment of every student in reading and math and reporting that data. That's still called for in the federal law. What's different is every state is now free to describe their own accountability systems as to how they want to chart the path for success. And there's a lot of good in that local control aspect. The bad news is there's a lot of slippage. There's a lot of fine print in those plans, those state plans. And frankly, I'm concerned that a lot of students are not being attended to. I mean, I'm a big, what gets measured gets done kind of gal. And when we forget about those kids, they go unattended to.
When we come back, we'll talk to Margaret Spellings, president of the University of North Carolina, about campus safety, among other issues. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Margaret Spellings, the president of the University of North Carolina, is with us today. And No Child Left Behind was a brainchild of the Bush administration, and you were the Secretary of Education at that time. And there were a lot of people who were very happy about that, and there were other people not so happy about that. And now the program has been altered a little bit, and it's up to the states.
That's right.
Is that a problem for you as an architect of this?
Well, what I know is that we tried that approach for many, many, many decades, kind of a put the money out and hope for the best. And we saw an achievement gap that was widening or at best flat. And when the federal government said, you know what, we invest a lot in poor and minority and special education students, and we want to see some results for them in exchange. And so when we required states to have accountability plans that were more muscular, we saw improvement, just simple as that. And it did. It pinched a lot of people, got their attention, but that tells me that it was working. And the results were just better. Now it's the era of local control, and everybody's doing their own thing.
You, I hope I'm not betraying a confidence here, but off the air, you said you're more of a federal control kind of Republican. Betsy DeVos, the current Secretary of Education, you pointed out, is more of a local control person. She has a different philosophy. And I believe you said that she was shocked to discover that the state programs that do this aren't very good.
She chided the school superintendents, the state chiefs, a couple of weeks ago and said that she was appalled at the kind of state plans that were being submitted that represented a major retreat for poor and minority students. So the reason that I'm a Republican that believes that when we invest billions and billions of tax dollars on behalf of poor, minority, and special education students, we ought to get something for it. I mean, I'm an accountability kind of Republican. And so I think there's a right balance about, you know, kind of state control and local control and, you know, federal intervention.
Betsy DeVos, the current Secretary of Education, has had a rough couple of weeks in recent weeks. What is your impression of her and or of the job she's doing?
Well, I know that it is a hard job, and every single person that shows up as the U.S. Secretary of Education, I'm sure, of all stripes or political affiliations, is a person of goodwill who wants to do right by the students of this country, and I know she is among that that group. I think those of us who have spent more time in the public arena maybe have less of a learning curve about how government works, about how those programs work, and so forth. And so, you know, I commend her for stepping into the arena. It's a tough time to be in public life. I know that, too. And it's a hard job.
Well, I was going to ask you, because you have been the subject of fear and loathing when you came into this job, is she being unfairly judged?
Well, I think in some ways, yes. You know, I know her. I think she's a person of goodwill. I think she, you know, means what she says. I think she believes that parents and students ought to have the best opportunities possible, as we all do.
Because in her interview on 60 Minutes, she kind of, from time to time, looked like a deer in the headlights. She kind of reminded me of the Sarah Palin interview on 60 Minutes. Was she unprepared? Had she never thought about some of these things? Is she uninformed? Does she not know what she needs to know to do the job? That's my question.
My observation about that, having seen the interview, is, you know, there is something to be said for people who have lots of experience in the public arena and in the public sector. Mm-hmm. And so her predecessors, myself included, probably had more experience doing that than she does. Can she learn the business? You bet she can. I think one of the things I worry about, and I'm going to say in my remarks today, there's value and relevance and respect and import in people who serve in public life. And we should not denigrate that, lest we have not very good people running our government.
Because there are a lot of people who are afraid of people like Betsy DeVos because of her very big support of charter schools and vouchers for other kinds of education other than the public schools, that the real agenda here is to rid ourselves of these pesky public schools, to just underfund them, move kids out, and leave only the poorest kids in the public school system. Is that the agenda?
I don't think so. It's not possible and it's not desirable. I mean, the choice agenda is one I support, and it is that, you know, parents ought to have options of all kinds. But the vast, vast majority of our students are going to attend our public schools, and we best make them work, or we're not going to live in a very wonderful country, the global innovator, and those students are not going to have very bright prospects. So our public schools have to thrive. Yes, we need options. Yes, we need charter schools. Yes, we need choice. But we need a mighty public school institution.
Are those public schools serving us well? I mean, they did for years, but do they now? When a public school graduate comes to the University of North Carolina system, are they prepared? Are they ready for the college level?
Some are and some aren't.
Why are some not? How does that happen?
Because we ration rigor. We don't send very good teachers. Those schools are under-resourced. They don't offer a college-ready curriculum, on and on and on. There are lots of reasons, and that's why the public policy role our universities plays in this debate is also important. Hmm.
Let's talk, excuse me, about campus safety. It's one of your priorities.
Yes, absolutely.
As Secretary of Education under President Bush, you helped manage the federal role in the aftermath of the Virginia Tech shooting.
Yes.
You led a day-long administration-wide conference on school safety. What came out of that conference?
What we learned was there was some disconnect between our schools, our education institutions, K-12 and higher education, and law enforcement and mental health, and that we had to be more seamless about our approaches. I'm proud to say, fast forward many years, and I commend Erskine Bowles, your native son here, who was in this role at the time, for taking a very bold approach on school safety in this university. Every single institution has a plan. They do regular drills and tabletop exercises. We just had one in UNC Greensboro that involved the whole community, the hospital, the law enforcement, and so on. And they're expensive to do, but they also are the old ounce of prevention worth a pound of cure. They prepare people for, God forbid, the kind of incident we saw at Parkland.
Yeah, but it happened at Parkland, and it happened at Sandy Hook, and it's happened elsewhere. Did anybody listen to any of the results that came out of your conference on school safety?
They did. They absolutely did. And I think what we have seen in Parkland in particular, just because it's so current, is that the school did everything right. They had plans, they had systems, they had, and there were some failings, as we know, on the law enforcement side in that instance. Can we, you know, is this something we have to be relentless about every single day? You bet. But we have made a lot of investment and given a lot of attention to this issue in the system.
We've been having a lot of conversations about this for obvious reasons.
Right.
How do you keep a school campus safe, whether it is a grade school or a high school or a college campus, particularly when you have to change classes between buildings and you can't put one of those walls that the president wants to put up between Mexico and the United States around every school? How do you keep those campuses secure?
Well, part of it, of course, as you say, is physical plan. I mean, can the doors lock and all those sorts of things? And we're doing an inventory right now and going to ask the legislature for funds if we need to make sure that our facilities are as adaptable as possible. But the truth of the matter is, this is a day-to-day campus culture issue. Mm. We have to look out for each other. We have to talk to each other. We have to make sure our counselors and advisors and our faculties are, you know, paying attention, that students are paying attention, kind of a when you see something, say something kind of attitude and kind of ethic. We have to have places where people can air their frustrations, their anxieties, their grievances. And so that's all about creating a culture that's healthy on a university or school campus.
University of California, I think, brought together experts on school violence, and they released an 8-point call for action to prevent gun violence in the United States of America. That's the name of the report. UNC has endorsed this. What does it entail?
Well, it's a combination of things. It's mental health in nature. It's those support systems that I've just talked about. It's making sure we have law enforcement capacity and physical plant capacity that can prevent incidents if and when they occur. It's a variety of things, and it's just, you know, we have to be relentless about it every day, and it has to be tailored to the institution.
Now, two of the items on the University of California's list. Two of the recommendations included a ban on assault-style weapons, high-capacity ammunition clips, along with products that modify semi-automatic weapons, enabling them to function like automatic weapons, like the bump stock thing, and universal background checks to screen out certain people who may, all of that, it seems to me, may have great difficulty in this political climate.
As you know, the Speaker Moore and maybe others are working on legislative recommendations, and obviously I have some opinions about some of those things, and during my Bush days, you know, was on the record about a lot of them. I think, those are all ripe for consideration in the legislative session coming up.
You're proposing what is called a third way.
The third way deals as much with sexual assault and those issues. And the third, when I say a third way, is, you know, do we have the kind of due process systems that allow us to bring to bear the right kind of expertise, mental health, law enforcement, and education,
right,
to deal with some of those issues? And I've, you know, talked with some leaders in the federal government and the Senate and Secretary DeVos and others about creating a pilot program with some special courts that we have with child abuse and other things like that that are, that's the third way, a different approach. So it's not just law enforcement or education.
And as you said, it's that third way is really about what's happening on campuses with sexual assault. How big a problem is that in the university system?
It's a problem everywhere, and some of it's tied to alcohol and those issues. But, you know, it's another thing that we have to be, you know, relentless about, as well as school safety, as we, you know, work to educate students.
Because on 60 Minutes with Leslie Stahl, the current Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, said she wasn't sure which was greater, the number of false accusations of sexual assault on campus or the number of campus rapes. And in the past, she has stressed importance of due process in sexual assault cases. And there have been false accusations of rape. We've seen several instances of that around the country. How do you help with due process in this third way?
Providing a forum that is separate from law enforcement and the educational institution that includes healthcare and mental health as part of that. So rather than try to do, you know, on-campus investigations 17 times over, there would be an adjudicating body that might bring additional expertise and frankly deal with some of the unevenness that we have, not just in this system, but all across the country. So it's just a notion. It's an idea. Some scholars have written about it, and I think it's worth considering.
Powers on Facebook writes, what are you doing to accommodate and protect undocumented students? First of all, is that your job?
It is not our job. It is the job of the federal government to deal in immigration policy. And I've been quite outspoken about this and something I worked on a lot during the Bush administration. I do believe, and I come from a state where we have in-state tuition for DACA students and others. And that is that, you know, once we have invested in, and this sounds like a crass economic argument, but these are students who have come to our state early in their lives. We have supported them through their K-12 systems. I met with a young woman not long ago who was the valedictorian of her class, wanted to be a social worker, was paying out-of-state tuition, et cetera. She arrived here at 6 years old. She doesn't speak Spanish. She knows no other country. And I think, you know, those are students that we have to be compassionate towards and understand that, you know, she's going to make a heck of a social worker.
Are you under pressure to report them, to turn them in if you know that they're there?
No, we don't have any kind of counting, way that we count DACA students.
Right.
But my hope is that the Congress will address this issue, and soon.
Margaret Spellings, our guest today on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. You've had some difficulty in your 2-year tenure with the university's Board of Governors. There was a months long board battle over the UNC Center for Civil Rights. Maybe about a year ago, it seems now. That's a pro bono legal center on campus. The board stripped the center's authority to litigate on behalf of clients. The Raleigh News and Observer called for you to weigh in with a recommendation. Did you? I don't remember.
I did not. The Board of Governors is an energetic, active, and engaged group of individuals who've been appointed by the legislature. They represent their own views, and I work for them. I'm at their service.
Well, the News and Observer says there's a power struggle between you and them. Is there?
I wouldn't say a power struggle. Do we have differences of opinion on issues? Sure, mm-hmm. Of course we do. Are those issues things we, you know, worked through? Absolutely. You know, they unanimously adopted the strategic plan that I was a major advocate for. So there are differences of opinion around a variety of issues. But on the big stuff, we're in complete alignment.
We have an email comment about Silent Sam regarding the Confederate monument at Chapel Hill and growing calls for that statue to be removed. And I believe... I only know what I read in the papers, but the News and Observer.
You know better than that, Mike.
The News and Observer says that board members complained to you in a strongly worded letter about your handling of the issues surrounding the Silent Sam Confederate statue on that campus. And you had asked the governor for state help with security prior to a protest in August of last year, and the board took issue with that request. Why?
They sent that letter to me after Carol Folt, the chancellor of UNC Chapel Hill, her board chair and my board chair and I, the four of us, sent a letter to the governor in the aftermath of the incidents in Charlottesville,
right.
And where we had gotten, you know, a lot of, you know, intel that something potentially could have broken out at Chapel Hill. And we did indeed have protests with hundreds and hundreds of people. And so as I thought about it, you know, what am I going to say to a mom if we haven't, you know, sent up a flare? So they wrote that letter in the aftermath of that, and it was an area where we disagreed.
Well, we saved the worst for last. So we'll move on from there. I want to thank you for coming back. I think this is the third time you've been on this program. So come back again next year or whenever you want.
Thanks, Mike. I'd love to. Appreciate your interest.
Margaret Spellings, president of the University of North Carolina.